Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
It's time for the show that brings the magic right to your speakers. Ears Up!
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Ears Up. We are back. And let me tell you, the week that I've had in this studio is like, I thought my audio problems were done. And, you know, I got that nice Rodecaster and I was ready to go. And then the thing started fritzing out on me and my brain has been scrambled. I get so scrambled with these kind of like audio issues. And I just,
there's a thin tendril of smoke rising up next to you. Can you hit it with a shoe right now?
I feel exhausted because it's like, these are problems routing audio that I haven't had to think about in, you know, 2 years, 3 years, whatever, since I got that. And I thought everything was done. But the problem with digital stuff is that sometimes the screen flickers and you can't trust if it's going to record at all or crash in the middle of a show and you need to replace it. You need to get rid of it because you can't trust it. It is untrustworthy equipment at that point. And that you can't, I can't have that.
Well, and I think even more to the point, it did absolutely shut off and you could not turn it on and you couldn't even get your in-depth show for a while.
That's so terrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, once you got it back on, yeah, that trust is just dead.
Yeah. And the people at Rode, they're in Australia, I think. So you get one email from them at 8 o'clock at night and that's it. You don't get a second email a day.
I mean, you could stay up later.
I did.
Oh,
and I was like, hey, is there any way that I can like get on a live chat? Because I have 3 shows to record this week. And he was like, no, we don't actually have that. But, you know, you want us to look at it? Yeah, I want you to look at it, homie. This is an expensive machine. I need this. So I had to like go out and buy a secondary, like I'm back to the analog, like with the dials and everything, running cables, trying to figure it out. But with my friggin' computer being what it is, it's the amount of inputs and outputs is all boring stuff. But it's such a pain to get everything to work right the way that I do things. It's not like a normal podcast where you're just recording and then you add everything in post and you kind of do whatever. We're live because I like that live interaction. I like the chat room stuff. I like having audio. I like being able to play that stuff. And I can't do it right now. I just can't do it. So here we are.
Thomas in the chat is offering, Thomas, who's in Australia, is offering to be your middleman.
If you want to, Thomas, yes, dude. You know, but yeah, I don't know.
He also had the great idea that we should have one of these companies sponsor the show.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Then we can just get it free. But then we have to talk about how great it is. And that's going to be the hard part.
Sure. Well, well, mainly we have to share our listener numbers and, you know, Sennheiser or Behringer isn't going to touch us.
We're just a skosh under 20,000.
Sure.
Skosh.
Oh, if you want proof of that? Well, I'm sorry. I can't provide that to you at this time.
Oh, because my because my mixing board is on fire.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But anyway, we have a great show for you today. We have the history of Mr. Toad's Wild Ride in Disneyland. And I did a lot of research on it. It's like half about the man who designed it, Bill Martin, and the other half is about the ride. I mean, the ride is the ride. There's not a whole lot of like real history to it. It hasn't really been, it's been touched like twice, but it's still fascinating information. I have like 7 pages to go through and a couple cool Walt quotes and a couple things about Walt and about the park on opening day and, you know, just kind of like little nuggets of information. But this was pretty cool. It was a fun little experiment because I love Toads.
Oh,
I think Toads is a great ride. And a lot of people poo-poo it, and I don't understand why. I really don't. I don't get it.
I'm delighted every time because I come from a Walt Disney World background where it was the greatest ride ever created, in my opinion, and at least I get a taste of it. I'm sorry you still have an inferior Toad at Disneyland. I shouldn't call it inferior. It exists.
Right. Yeah, it's better than the one you have right now in Disney World.
Yeah, which is a Winnie the Pooh ride.
Which is Winnie the Pooh. Right.
I was going to say, there isn't one.
No, not anymore.
Oh, okay.
They turned half of it into a gift shop. So, you know.
I mean, whatever. It was a lot of real estate, you know, and they looked at it and they're like, wow, we could really pack a lot of souvenirs in this. Wow, Taryn blinded herself.
Wow, look at that.
There you go.
Yeah. Listen to the Supreme Resort. We did a whole thing, a whole really weird thing on Halloween about Walt Disney World Toad.
There you go. You can do that. And if you want to go to Disney World and you can lay flowers at the site of the former Toad ride, you can book your trip with Concierge. You go to concierge.com today and figure out the best ways to go to the parks, which is to have somebody else plan it for you. Honestly, that's what we all kind of want. We want to be able to go because the parks have made it so hard. Bob Iger has made it so impossible to figure out how to book a trip.
All Bob.
Just don't do it. Some it's Bob. Like with me and my audio. If someone would go, hey, brother, let me plan all this for you. You just pay the money. I would go, yes. Are you going to charge me for that opportunity? And they would say, no. I would say then double yes. And that's the same thing as concierge. They don't charge extra for it. They don't charge any extra to help you plan your vacation. But if you want help making reservations, navigating Genie Plus, getting park reservations, all of that kind of stuff, they do it all for you and it's for free. So check them out, concierge.com. And in fact, you know, I've been talking about doing these giveaways. I meant to like solidify all that this week, but I had to, you know, obviously do all this audio stuff. But I think what I'm going to do, I have a couple, actually I have five boxes over there. One, two, three, six, five, whatever. Of prize packs already gifted or already boxed up and I'm going to be giving them away. There's a lot of cool stuff in there. Two are from Patreon people. So all you have to do is just be a Patreon supporter and you're going to get a prize pack. And there's like a shirt and you know a bunch of stuff, right?
You're in a raffle for one. You don't have... it's not everybody.
Everybody gets one. No. Yeah, I'm gonna pick and choose and it'll probably be on the Christmas show, which is like in a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And then I want to do a giveaway on social media for everybody else, probably three prize packs there. And I think one of those is going to be, and you guys, you know, listening live, or listening, you know, back to this, you can send an email too if you want, or you can leave a voicemail on the what is it called? Website? Yeah, you can go to our website, earsup-podcast.com. Okay. Yeah, and leave a voicemail if you want. And I want to hear a Christmas story that involves Disneyland or a Disney trip or something like that. Give me some sort of content and around that. What's a good Christmas memory you have? Or excuse me, a scary Christmas movie or a Christmas memory? Or funny Christmas memory, or something like that involving the parks in some capacity. And if you want to send me an email through there too, you can just do that as well. But if you want to leave a voicemail, that'd be fine too. But the best one of those, and we're going to put this on social also, so people can, you can just write it on, you know, leave a comment underneath the social post. But, and then we'll pick, you know, two or three of those winners and give them some stuff. So it'd be fun. So be sure to check that out.
It's good stuff. It's like, it's Ears Up vintage.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. It's a couple stuff from our 100th episode and, you know, stuff, the books.
We like stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
And things.
You know, before I get to the show, Jeremy and I were talking on In Depth, and I had put this to the Discord a couple days ago, but I had a thought experiment for everybody and I want to run it by you guys. I want to get your opinion on this. My thought is, so Hall of Presidents in Disney World, let's pretend they got rid of it.
Okay.
My feeling, my vibe, that's not long for this earth. So why don't we help the company out now and plan what would go there? What should be in Hall of Presidents in Disney World that doesn't exist yet?
Okay.
My thing is something with Sam the Eagle. Some Muppets kind of thing. I think that would be cool. A few people in Discord had some really cool ideas. Maybe we should pull those up.
Yeah. While you're bringing those up.
Yeah.
I saw that question earlier this week and it just suddenly clicked. And I haven't listened to In Depth yet. I'm a couple days behind on things. But the outside of the Hall of Presidents, there used to be fairly recently, there used to be a Muppets show about American history. I think you retool the Muppets show to draw people inside and do your Muppets history show. do it bigger than they used to do it, because watching that, watching the Muppets do American history outside in Liberty Square, I remember I was so excited to see it. And we walked through and one was starting and I turned around. My wife said, "Why are you crying?" Like, it's wow. So good. It's so good.
Yeah.
So I look forward to listening to your take on the Muppets thing. I don't want to like steal your Muppets idea, but do the puppet show outside to draw people into the Hall of Presidents.
Sure. And then have a bigger show.
Yeah.
I don't have the show planned out, by the way. It's just literally Sam the Eagle. That's it. I don't know. Chip.
I love Chip.
You know, Pepe the King Prawn. Like, well, you know.
Oh, of course.
What else? Yeah. You know, the classic, the hitter, the heavy hitters.
Right. But yeah, have them tell the stories of various things. And yeah.
Yeah, because you know, Hall of Presidents, like you can't really, I don't know. I feel like that sort of level of patriotism doesn't really resonate anymore with a lot of people. And I think you need to switch it up.
So I have a thought.
Uh-oh.
At Disneyland, of course, we don't have Hall of Presidents, the show. We have Abe Lincoln, right?
Sure.
So you want to replace it with something similar to that, like where it's an animatronic human historical figure.
Sure.
Do you? Because
I think
people don't go to that.
Yeah, that is true.
Except for like me and Dan. I don't know.
That's true. But
I go to it because I like being in there, but I don't like the show.
Yeah.
The show is thoroughly boring.
It is.
Yeah.
But
I mean, I would rather be in history class taking notes than listening to this, like, you know, patriotic music. I just don't. It's not my, I don't know.
Yeah. What if it was instead of the Hall of Presidents, instead of Abraham Lincoln, it's along the same lines, but it's Martin Luther King Jr. doing his I Have a Dream speech.
That would be.
I think it makes perfect sense.
That would spark a war unlike this country has ever seen before. There's no way.
I don't.
A civil war, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe. Brother might fight against cousin.
I don't know that it would. I mean, he's a pretty commonly known. I mean, it's
commonly known, but there's a section of people who would not enjoy that, and I feel like they live in
they
that
all
area.
Live they all
yeah.
live there.
So you know, I don't know.
Maybe.
I don't know. I'm just putting it out there. Yeah. You know what? We can come back to it if you guys want.
We can mothball the very elaborate statues of presidents, and that's why putting cartoon characters, well, the puppet characters in there is less crazy.
Yeah. Well, I think that, anyway, I think
they putting should, a major American figure.
Yeah, again and again. I think Hall of Presidents should be on the short list to get rid of. I don't know. That whole thing,
I agree with you. That needs to go.
It does. It needs to go.
It's too controversial. American presidents are too controversial.
That's right.
These days.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Okay. You know what? Let's do. We're gonna do toads, and then we're gonna go because the drink we have to make is fairly complicated.
Uh oh,
Eric. I mean, I haven't made any coffee for it. Have you?
I have leftover coffee from this morning. Enough to...
What? Darren, get a load of this guy. He has leftover coffee.
I've never even heard of that.
Sometimes I leave before I finish the pot, and then I have to make more coffee at work. Hmm. That's basically it. Yeah.
Why don't you get a to-go cup?
Yeah, or a thermos is what it's also called.
No. I bring a thermos of coffee to work. But I have coffee at home and then I fill my thermos and there's usually enough coffee left to make this particular drink.
Okay.
Mm. Well, hey, look, man.
It's very precise.
Okay.
It sounds really precise and that's what I really appreciate.
All right.
Okay.
All right, Mr. Toads. Well, you know, what I'm realizing when researching Mr. Toad's Wild Ride history is you can't talk about Mr. Toad's Wild Ride without talking about the man responsible for the direction of it all, Mr. Bill Martin. Bill Martin left 20th Century Fox in 1953 to help Walt create the Disneyland park. He was an art director and set designer, so as you can imagine, these skills were highly useful in manifesting Walt's vision of Disneyland. Dick Irvine was the man who brought Bill over to Walt Disney Studios And in the lead up to actual construction of the park, Bill toured many theme parks on the East Coast to dig up inspiration. Fairmount Park in Philly, Palisades Park in Jersey, and other parks in New Orleans, Cincinnati, etc. Bill was part of that original WED group with names like Harper Goff, Bill Cottrell around him. They had offices above the Main Street City Hall when the park opened, which kind of makes more sense as to why Walt's apartment was located on the other side of that building. This I didn't know. There were WED office buildings above City Hall.
That's the dream. That's the dream. Is not only do you work for WED, but you work in Disneyland.
Your office is the park.
Yeah.
I mean, which made sense because the park, you know, admittedly wasn't finished when it opened.
Right.
And everybody knew that. And Walt knew that it wasn't a secret. Right. So what better place are you going to? And every Saturday, Walt would go with the heads of each of the areas and do a park walkthrough before the park opened and say, what can we do better? How can we expand this every week?
Yeah.
So it's, of course, they're going to be on site.
And office space wise, that was either amazing or absolute trash.
Well, considering Walt lived down the hall, essentially, you know, because you have City Hall and then you got the bathrooms or whatever. And then there's the firehouse. Right. So you have your offices and then a hallway and then Walt's apartment.
And it's all forced perspective. So it's also a little smaller. Maybe I haven't been up there, but isn't it smaller?
It's small.
It looks small.
That apartment is very small. I don't know what's up there now. I should ask what's up there now, but probably storage. You know, no one
wigs. It's the wig department.
Can you imagine being the dude who has the office and say, "Oh, well, it's my office now." Yeah, you know, it's like everyone would be so mad at you.
Oh yeah.
But anyway, I thought that was fascinating. I didn't know that. I had no idea that there were offices. Right there. Originally named as the set director for Fantasyland, seemingly back when Walt was still looking at this park as more of a movie set than what it morphed into. But after opening day, Walt knew he needed someone to manage his future expansion ideas. So Bill went on to supervise the park's expansion over the next decade. He later became vice president of design for Walt Disney World and was responsible for so many improvements and additions to the parks. He was in charge of the master layout of the Magic Kingdom. He did the track layouts for basically all fantasy rides, the Mine Train through Nature's Wonderland. And it was actually his idea for not only the Mine Train, but as well as the Donkey Ride, which Walt loved. He was a big fan of the Donkey Ride. And
great.
Bill worked on the small storefronts that used to be in the Mine Train area that are now part of that last leg of Big Thunder. You know, we were coasting into Disembark, the saloon and whatever, and you can hear all those things. Bill worked on those. Bill did the layout for the Pirates of the Caribbean and Haunted Mansion tracks. Both of those he laid out. Bill contributed to Bear Country somehow. I'm not really entirely sure on that. He did the layout for the submarine ride, for the motorboat ride, for the monorail. He was responsible for weaving the monorail through the Autopia area, doing that whole layout. He was responsible for the Matterhorn layout, Chicken of the Sea pirate ship. And then in researching this, I learned that the mermaid on the bow of that ship was based off of Tinkerbell, which I don't know if seems like something we should have talked about before, but I was like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
He laid out the track for the storybook canal boats. He did the waterworks for Swiss Family Treehouse and on and on and on. And Bill was an indispensable part of the team and did so much of the basics and the foundations for Disneyland and those like classic attractions. Bill had a lot of ideas for adding little fun attractions into Disneyland. He once wanted to put what's called a camera obscura at the top of Sleeping Beauty Castle, but apparently there wasn't enough light for the camera to work.
Too bad.
Dating back to it. Do you guys know what a camera obscura is?
It's like a hidden camera.
No. I'll tell you, but I just didn't know.
Well, yeah. It's some sort of optical effect inside a building. And
dating back to at least the 1600s, camera obscuras are basically a pinhole camera that you would use to view a solar eclipse without burning your retinas out. The name comes from the Latin words for dark, which is obscura, and room, which is camera. In the 1700s and 1800s, the camera obscura was also a useful accessory for the wealthy taking the grand tour of like Italy or whatever to make drawings of landscapes or classical ruins. The camera would project a reversed image of whatever it was pointed at, and that would allow artists to essentially trace a landscape. And there are actually some art historians who think more than a few master painters like Rembrandt and Vermeer used this technique to bring an extra layer of detail to their paintings. Maybe it's cheating. I don't know. But the camera obscura is only focusing and reflecting light and not capturing it. The next big leap was when in the 1800s was to combine a device like a camera obscura with a material that would alter when exposed to the light and would then preserve the image. So it's the earliest camera.
Wow.
It was cool. Based off of this. The image is so cool, they want to try to capture that. And that's why you see, you know, a lot of like Victorian era or early era photographers with their head over the camera,
yeah,
under the blanket. It's because you need a darkened room to get the light just right. You need too much light will kill your view, and it'll ruin the image.
Okay,
this ties in perfectly with the window that I'm not allowed to talk about tonight. George K. Whitney. I'm sorry. There's a camera obscura thing with the window.
Well, you know what? If we have time, we'll talk about it.
Okay, yeah, if we have time. Otherwise, we'll save it for another time, and everybody will know about camera obscura, and I don't have to talk about what that means again.
There you go. Now, I wasn't sure what function this camera obscura would serve way at the top of the castle, but I did find out there's a camera obscura in San Francisco. It's actually like a really famous landmark that's been there for over 100 years. The San Francisco camera obscura projects an image onto a horizontal viewing table via a reflected image from a viewpoint at the top of the building. Which is on the at the Cliff House, the old Cliff House.
Oh,
there.
Okay.
So it was there in like the early 1900s. Then the Cliff House burned down, and it was rebuilt in 1906. Whatever. A metal hood in the cupola at the top of the building slowly rotates, makes a full revolution in about 6 minutes, allowing for a 360-degree view around the building. Light enters the building via an angled mirror in the metal hood. It then passes through a lens and is projected onto a parabolic white table in a black room. So this camera would be constantly rotating atop the castle, showing folks down at the bottom in a dark room, basically an aerial view of the park.
Wow.
Okay.
Right.
I'm going to interject here because literally George Whitney Jr., who has a window on Main Street, owned that building.
What building? The Cliff House?
The camera obscura and the Cliff's House.
That's awesome.
Wow.
What?
Man, look at us.
I had no idea this was getting into where you're going.
Yeah,
but
neither did I.
But yeah, and we'll talk about it someday.
Yeah, and these are the things. It has nothing to do with Toad. You know, barely has anything to do with Bill Martin, but it's like his idea. But I thought it was so fascinating. Imagine going to the castle now, and you go into a room, which maybe presumably is that maybe the handicap viewing room, if you don't want to go through the thing. Maybe you're just in there, and you see just this rotating like view of the park. I think that'd be so amazing.
That'd be really,
that's really cool.
Yeah. Speaking of the castle, Bill gave an interview years ago where he reflected on why he liked working with Walt so much and vice versa. And this was a little Walt interaction that I thought was pretty funny. I have a couple long quotes from Bill here, so bear with me. He says, quote, "We were walking back to the animation building from Bob Matley's." Matley was a special effects guy at Disneyland. So maybe his office or something. And Walt says to me, "You know, Evan Earle thinks that the castle turrets should be different colors, orange and black and pink and red and purple and yellow. What do you think about that?" I said that they should all be blue like slate. He said, "I think you're right." A lot of the guys who had worked with Walt a long time didn't want to make decisions until they had gotten input from him somehow. I came from Fox Studios, and when they asked me a question there, I told them what I thought. So I did that when I went to work for Disney. I guess Walt appreciated some outside thinking. I remember a time when this one guy was working on some ideas for Fantasyland. See, you can always tell when a story's never going to go well.
Oh, yeah.
This one guy.
Yeah.
This one guy was working on some ideas for Fantasyland, and I was in the meeting when he was showing these marvelous drawings to Walt. Walt was there looking at them, and Dick Irvine and myself were there. I don't remember if John Hench was there or not. When this guy got all through explaining his stuff, he said to Walt, quote, "You know, if you can't do it this way, I don't know how you're going to do it." Walt didn't say a word. The next day, the guy was gone. Walt didn't like that hard sell kind of talk. Walt appreciated flexibility from his people, and he usually knew in the back of his mind what he wanted. If you can't do it this way, brother, I don't know how it's going to get done. Peace. Gone.
Wow. Deuced.
Yep.
I want to know who that was and where they went to. Because that, yeah, what a good story. I got fired from Walt Disney for trying to hard sell my ideas.
Yeah. No. Well, not thinking outside the box enough for Walt.
Yeah. Not being open enough to Walt's ideas. Yep. And that's all, you know, that's all I think Walt wanted. Here's my idea. If you can have a better idea, I want to hear it. Mm-hmm. If not, yeah, then that's do fair. What I want to do, which is totally fair. I mean, he's the boss. He's the money guy. You know? On opening day, Bill was one of the people who actually lowered the drawbridge to signify the opening of the park or whatever it was.
It's right? a big deal.
It's a huge, yeah. I mean, it's kind of neat, right?
They did that like twice.
Yeah.
So here's like two paragraph quote from Bill telling the story. It's a fascinating story. On opening day, I hung around inside the castle. I was one of the guys that helped raise and lower the drawbridge by hand. The show started and the ABC cameras came down Main Street and up to the bridge. We raised the portcullis and lowered the drawbridge, and all the Disney characters went running out into the hub. I was back there inside the castle, off camera. We had quite a scare at the beginning. I think it was the day before. There was a small gas leak somewhere under the castle, and there were a few little blue flames along the base of the structure in the courtyard opposite Merlin's Magic Shop. You know, the park was built so fast that they laid down a lot of cable and pipes without records. And the guy that found them later was Bill Evans when he went to plant the trees and bushes with his backhoe. This was the day when the press was all around and they were hoping to get this problem on film. I guess they wanted to see Sleeping Beauty Castle go up in smoke. The reporters were there and one of the cameramen even was up on a big ladder. The park publicity people were pleading with the reporters and cameramen not to take a picture if a fire started. That would have been traumatic just before the grand opening. Then I came strolling along through the side entrance and up the walk, and I was smoking a pipe at the time. I had no idea what was going on inside of there. All of a sudden, the fire chief came running out of the castle, took me by the arm, and ran me down to the hub. He was afraid I was going to blow up the place.
Oh my gosh.
So nobody told Bill Evans where the gas lines were. He's just there doing his backhoe things, planting trees, you know, doing landscaping stuff, which is what he was doing. Busts a gas main. There's blue flames shooting at the outside of the castle. They're trying to fix it. Here comes Bill Martin just smoking a pipe going, "What's up, boy?"
Wow.
Oh, no.
That was great, man. What a good story.
As bad as things were on opening day, it could have been worse.
Could have not happened. Yeah.
Yeah. You burned down the castle and you don't have a park.
No.
Wasn't there a gas leak on in Tomorrowland on opening day?
Oh, maybe.
I believe it.
We should do an opening day show.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
To anchor Fantasyland, Walt already had Snow White and Peter Pan rides planned, and Toads was the third ride that Walt wanted. Toads was loosely based off the Disney adaptation of the Wind in the Willows book. The ride puts the guest in the place of Mr. Toad as he is overcome with motor mania, which is a very real thing and not one. And it's one that we should all be afraid of. You know, we shouldn't take this lightly, this motor mania thing, guys. I'm serious. The interesting thing about Toads that separates it from other fantasy rides is that it isn't really like the source material at all. The ending specifically is not in the 1949 movie version, nor the book it was based on. It was completely fabricated. Another point of interest is that when Toads opened, it had the least amount of 3D figures of its Fantasyland counterparts. Snow White and Peter Pan both were packed with figures, while Toad relied mostly on 2D plywood painting. It's just a budget thing at that point. Walt chose the specific scene elements of the Toad book to be in the ride that he wanted. The rest were added in later based on how much room they would have in the show building, which is already very small to begin with. When the ride first opened, everything inside was simple stage scenery, which played to Bill Martin's strength, right? Like set dressing, like you would see in a play. Two-dimensional paintings that were basically meant to be seen from one direction only. But since most of it was painted for blacklight, you only ended up seeing what they wanted you to see. So they were able to really control what you saw. It was a great way to do it. It was a cheap way to do it as well. And sometimes you come across pictures of the inside of that ride before it was redone, and the art looks sort of odd and, I don't know, kind of weird. You know, like it was this Disney quality stuff, but the guests wouldn't have seen it that way. They would have seen it with a black light. So it was a very different experience. Black lights were a new feature that no other rides were really using in the parks the Imagineers went to. So these three dark rides of Toad, Pan, and Snow were the first real sort of dark rides as we know them today. In the past, there weren't really, they didn't have black lights. They weren't trying to use these sort of special effects. They were just dark rides. But Bill Martin and the team sort of created this vibe. Now we think of dark rides as having black lights.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure.
Guests waiting in line were treated to the confusing lyrics of the Merrily song, and the enthusiastic voice of Mr. Toad himself, provided by Eric Blore, the voice actor from the film. So that was a nice touch. And he beckoned all to come along with him on his travels. Just come along, hop up on here. We'll go for a jolly ride. Buford Road, the dusty highway. Come, I'll show you the world. Travel, change, excitement. Sounds like Yoda. Travel, change, excitement.
Well, and so what's interesting is you said that it doesn't follow the movie. So when I've, the first probably five times I went on this ride, and I've probably been on it eight in my life.
What?
I did not even know that there was a movie. I had no idea what this ride Nobody was. Does. It was just the ride that you go on because everything else is too busy.
Right.
But that said, it's interesting that not only is it not really based on the movie, which is also confusing, yeah. It is also just completely made up, but it doesn't make any sense anyway. Like they took something that was hard to follow and they made it even harder to follow. And then they were like, it's a ride.
Yeah. You know, what they didn't do like with Snow White, because it, you know, following the movie doesn't right. work well. I mean, look at the Snow White ride. I think Pinocchio's yeah. journey did that too. Pan is sort of similar to Toad, to where it doesn't really follow the book or the movie at all. You know, there's pieces that in that ride that aren't included, right? Mm-hmm. But it doesn't end up working well because you can't cram all of that in a minute and a half long ride, which is what these are, right?
Yeah.
So, like Toad's, I think I say later, is like 98 seconds. A minute, oh, wow. 98 seconds. Yeah. So it's not that long. Mm. So you have to do something to make it thrilling, you know, a little bit more thrilling than the actual movie. But
it's just the weirdest ride at Disneyland. Weird.
Absolutely.
It's so weird.
Absolutely.
Well, yeah. Toad started off as a roller coaster concept ride. The cars would follow a downhill track towards obstacles like parked cars that would move out of the way at the last minute. Walt thought this kind of thing would be a bit too scary for small kids and, quote, the elderly. So they toned it down a bit. So okay. Probably talking about U-turn.
Yeah.
However, according to Bill, going through the devil's mouth into hell was just fine by Walt.
Right. So, no, that's perfectly fine for children and yeah, the elderly.
Yeah. Hey, this is where you're going to be in about 5 years, Gramps.
Yeah. Don't worry about it.
Get used to it now. Which is funny because, you know, there's a lot of people online going like, oh, I don't know, Walt, they could go through hell? What kind of ride is this for Disneyland? Whatever. But yeah, Walt said that was great. He thought it was awesome. Loved it. I think it's awesome.
He's also a weird guy.
He's also weird, of course. As the show buildings were being constructed, or at least assembled, I'm a little bit unclear about this. What I read and what I think happened is that the show buildings for Fantasyland specifically were purchased from a company and then brought to the park and assembled. And then while this was happening, the ride was being mocked up on a soundstage in Burbank. The show buildings were prefabbed 60-foot by 100-foot metal buildings, either made by a company called Soleil, or Bill misspoke in this interview, and they're just called Soleil buildings. I couldn't really tell.
Huh.
But they're just big metal rectangles. Plop them down. There you go.
And Pretty much. Yeah.
And I think that showcases the time constraint that they were under. Where it's like, we don't have time to build these. Let's buy them and bring them in.
Yeah.
The original Fantasyland featured canvas tent facades attached to the outside of each of the buildings, and Toad's was no exception. So you look at these older pictures, up until 83, and just they look like a medieval jousting tent.
Yeah.
They look weird, honestly, but I guess it kind of fits, you know, the vibe of the time or whatever.
I guess, yeah. Yeah. And it's cheap and easy to do.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there can be. Yeah, you attach these canvas tents to the, there you go. In planning the ride, storyboards were made from numerous watchings of the Disney film. Ken Anderson, who was art director for many Disney films, and Claude Coates were the two in charge of really solidifying the scenes and what they would contain. Claude had a credit on the Toad movie for color styling, so his experience in this area really helped to transfer that same feeling of the cartoon over to the ride, specifically in like the painted murals and the loading areas, or just the way the characters looked in the ride. Also, Mary Blair was credited with color styling as well on this movie. And I think you kind of see that in specifically in the mural that they put in the loading, which wasn't there, I guess, for opening, but later on. The ride vehicles and the ride system itself were stock items made by Aero Development, and Bill only had three pieces of information to work with in designing this track layout. So they're going, okay, we're going with Aero. This is what you have to work with. Design me a ride before you have all the information. Here's what he had. He had the minimum turning radius of the cars, which was 4 feet. And he had the overall length of ride time, which was 1:38. And he had the overall building square footage. That's it. Using these three data points, he was able to lay the track down, set the main scenes that Walt and him would want, and then Claude and Ken would come in later and add the smaller points and, you know, whatever, right?
Wow.
Yeah. And the reason Toad is so twisty and turny is because of Peter Pan next door. That ride was built first, so it took the long portion of this rectangular show building. It takes the most of that show building, which left a very small footprint for Toad. So they had to maximize the space that they had to figure out how to make this ride tell a story with a 4 foot turning radius in 1.5 minutes.
Wow.
And it makes it feel so fast while you're spinning around these little corners.
Yes. Yeah,
a 4 foot turning radius is really tight.
Yeah.
It's scary fast. Yeah.
The ride was designed to eat up 700 people an hour. Only 9 cars were able to fit in the ride itself, with 3 out front to load guests at any given time, each entering Toad Hall every 11 seconds.
Wow.
Yeah, wow.
Seems like a long time. I don't know. You know what I mean?
11 seconds?
Yeah, 11 seconds. So you have 11 seconds to like load the car, empty the car, load the car, and then shoot it out. I don't know. Doesn't it sound like a long time?
No, it sounds short to me.
Short time.
Really?
Yeah, it sounds like to get people out and get people in.
Like, what's Space Mountain?
Who knows? I don't know.
I mean, that's pretty tight over there. Or like Big Thunder Mountain, where, yeah, you want it to be tight because you only have so much space. It's the same thing. You only have so much space to do it. But in a ride like this, you can slow things down. It's not quite the same as Pirates of the Caribbean, where you can just pile up a bunch of people at the bottom of the reverse waterfall.
Because, I mean, each car has like, what, 4 people? 2? There's a lot of pictures I see of like 2 people in these cars.
In the olden days.
Bruce Bushman designed the cars for Toad, and they were some of the very first pieces of equipment to actually even be delivered to Disneyland, which is kind of a neat little thing. Huh. They were designed to tilt backwards slightly in order to help that crazy feeling of the ride by shifting your perspective a bit while on it.
Okay.
This also allows that small guide wheel in the front to ride a single rail on the floor. Each vehicle has a 1/4 horsepower electric motor drawing power from the rail beneath its wheels. The cars are all named individually as Mr. Toad, McBadger, Moley, and Ratty, with 2 each named Toadie, Cyril, Winky, and Weasel. Various gags and plussings have been added over the years, starting in 1961. Here we have added doorways, more cops, revised figures, and in the 1983 Fantasyland revamp, the entrance to the ride changed completely. Guests entered a recreation of Toad Hall, passing by artistic works commemorating characters from the film. A large mural shows the adventures of Toad and his motor car, pre-shadowing various scenes in the ride. Disembodied voices sing the Merrily song, but it's more like the song from the version in the film. Now the cars crash through the fireplace in the beginning instead of simply drive it past it in the earlier version. The breakaway doors were a big addition in 1961 as well. And that's one of the things that I really remember when I think about this ride is, you know, you're going to the doors open at the last second, you know, these kind of sight gags, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And they added a lot of the stuff they were able to because they knew way more about what they were doing and how to build a ride that was exciting at this point. Before, they didn't really know what they were doing, but now it's like, oh, we could add this and that would be a good gag. And now that everything's here, I think it's settled in. And then now we know what we're working with. Like the cops in the ride, they were put in there to add a little bit of level of excitement. Like you're fleeing the police, right? Since we're supposed to have broken out of prison. So we should be probably being chased somehow. So you got the cops there. Additional character flats of Molly and McBadger and a human butler in Toad Hall, as well as Ratty in front of one of the painted storefronts in the village scene, and a handful of new police officers, including one on a motorcycle. Like I said, new crash doors, and these being a construction barricade located in the village street, multiple breakaway flats of stacked crates and kegs in the warehouse, fully sculpted devils and red rock in the hell scene replace the original flat 2D plywood painting. Then you have the great Fantasyland rebuild of 1983. The tent entrance to Toad was done away with, and a much more stately looking manor appeared in its place. Now Toad Hall looked the part and gave guests not only more cool theming to look at, but a larger loading area as well. When Disney World opened in Orlando, Florida in 1971, a new version of the ride debuted with dual tracks offering slightly different experiences, but still the same core experience. Friend of the show, Rolly Crump, was asked to design this ride, and it was his idea to not only split the rides and have two running at the same time to eat more people, but it was his idea to make each one of them different, so you never knew which one you were going to get.
That's cool.
Yeah.
It's very Rolly.
It's very Rolly, right? Like, I don't know. Well, Rolly, don't you think people are going to want to know? Whatever. I don't know.
I want them to be confused when they get out of the line.
Yeah, this will be fun for me. Who cares? Unlike its Disneyland counterpart, it never received the Toad Manor makeover, and visitors to Florida were subjected to a boxier kind of tournament tent-looking facade painted with really gross shades of purple. The left track featured such scenes as Toad's trophy room, a kitchen, a gypsy camp, and Winky's tavern, with a clever beer mug gag and weasels hiding among the barrels, and the rain room. The right track featured such scenes as Toad's library, a barnyard with animals and chickens scattering through the air, a policeman signaling you to stop, a courtroom where the policeman is now the judge. It just sounds exactly normal. A jail with weasels in the cells and a standoff between weasels and the police. Both tracks come together in a town square with both tracks circling it but never crossing. Both tracks have their own train tunnels and their own separate entrances to hell. At that point, they're both the same. So both versions of hell are the same, but they each have their own independent one.
Right.
News of the Disney World ride's potential closure first leaked in 1997 when inside sources revealed to the Orlando Sentinel that the Florida park was planning to replace it with a Winnie the Pooh ride. To many guests, this would not have come as a surprise. Disney was known to close old rides to make room for new ones that appealed to younger generations of visitors. The Winnie the Pooh franchise had been kept alive, whereas the Wind in the Willows, to Taryn's point, was largely unknown to kids raised during Disney Renaissance of like what, the 80s and 90s and stuff. Despite this, the threat to the ride struck a chord with certain guests. One day after the rumor broke, the website SaveToad.com went live. It implored... Actually, is it still up? Let's see.
What year was this?
It's archived. Because the guy who started the site works for Miami University.
There it is.
And it's archived on his site. I may have read about this a lot.
It is awesome. So if you go to SaveToad.com and redirects to math.miami.edu.
There you go.
And it is awesome. It says, we tried to save Mr. Toad's wild ride, but Eisner doesn't care about you.
Dang.
You need to read this site.
It's so good,
dude. If you haven't listened to the Supreme Resort's Halloween episode and heard about the story of Jeff Moscot, the main guy behind all of these efforts, you need to go there. He's a hero. This is the first time somebody went on the internet and said, we need to rally and show up and try to get Disney to change things. We need to be there on the last day. They had so many cast members on their side by the end.
Oh God.
And
yeah.
Disney dug in their heels. Listen,
I'm going to go through it a little bit, but
what was the website?
SaveToad.com.
Yeah, just search for it. You'll find it.
Just go to SaveToad.com. Yeah. It implored visitors to contact Disney with demands to save the ride. I mean, and this man has every single point of contact, telephone and snail mail for like the entire board, for all the important people. Marty Sklar. Everybody.
Oh, wow.
Just everybody. He's like, call these people, but be nice. But call them. Postcards pre-addressed to the company were made available to download. Fans, how progressive for 1997.
Yeah.
Just download this postcard, man. Fans could order t-shirts depicting a dead J. Thaddeus Toad on the front and a message on the back reading, "Ask me why Mickey is killing Mr. Toad."
Wow.
The online campaign eventually spilled into the real world. In May 1998, a plane flew over Disney World, dragging a banner that said, "Save Mr. Toad's Wild Ride," next to the park president's phone number.
Good old Al Weiss.
Devotees of the ride, who branded themselves Toadies, hosted something called Toad Inns in the Magic Kingdom to express their discontent. The crowds never grew beyond a few dozen people, but the protesters who did show up were passionate. In response to the article, Jeff Moskett, a University of Miami student, started a Save Toad website. Through the new media of internet discussion groups and fan websites, the campaign captured the imagination of Toad's loyal fans. As many as 50 t-shirt-wearing fans would attend weekly Toad-ins at the Magic Kingdom. Here's a sample from Mr. Toad Appears to Be Roadkill, an AP press article by Mike Schneider on Tuesday, September 1st, 1998. He says, "Despite protests, despite the green shirts saying, 'Ask me why Mickey is killing Mr. Toad,' despite hundreds of pleading postcards and letters mailed to Disney officials, Mr. Toad appears to be roadkill." A year-long internet and mail campaign to persuade Walt Disney World to keep Mr. Toad Wild Ride apparently wasn't enough, or so say Mr. Toad's champions, who claim the ride will be closed forever September 8th and replaced with a Winnie the Pooh attraction. The Save the Toad campaign is a strange twist on a David versus Goliath fight, with a group of admittedly obsessive fans challenging the nation's ever-present, cheery entertainment giant. I can't read that word for some reason. Quote, "Anyone who would be so nuts to challenge Disney and waste a whole year obviously has some issues," concedes Toad booster Jeff Moskett, 26 of Miami.
Wow.
This guy.
Yeah. Me and my followers are nuts. So says I. He was a systems administrator and film student behind SaveToad.com. He said, he told the Associated Press that it's a nice break from the happy singing flowers. Not that bland Disney hero with the too funny sidekick. He's nuts. He steals cars, but he's a good guy. When Disneyland Paris opened in 1992, guests found a Toad Hall similar to the full-size Toad Hall at Disneyland, but this wasn't a ride. It was, and still is, a counter-service restaurant. In keeping with Mr. Toad's setting in England, the restaurant features English fish and chips. And that's basically it. But back to the ending of the ride. After you're found guilty of, you know, having motor mania or whatever, and you presumably escape jail, you're racing around, you're hit by a train. You get distracted, you go through a train tunnel, and you get hit head on by a train. And then you get sent to hell. And then the ride ends. And that's it.
Lesson learned.
Yeah. And despite this being pretty clear cut, many people online still wonder if Toad is meant to die at the end of that ride. Because so you're in the car, you're Toad, right? This is just what a lot of those rides are, right? So you're Toad. You get hit by a train and then you're out. Did you escape hell? Some people go, "Oh, it must have been a dream." I don't know. What do you think? Do you think that this is one of the only rides I can think of where you die as the ending of the ride? It's probably the only one in existence. I'm just going
to
say.
Well, you also don't die and like go to a good place. You die and you go to hell.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you ran through a pub. You made some people, you broke some barrels. Like, geez, man.
Well, all I can tell you is I distinctly remember the first time I rode this ride. I still remember being in that car with my sister and heading toward that train and us screaming. And it was, it left, and this is at Walt Disney World, and it left such an indelible impression on us. And we realized that this is why I have such a devotion to this ride, because I remember it so well. And there are so many other things that other people cling to, the stuff from their childhood.
Sure.
Like people talk about Horizons at Epcot or whatever. For me, it's Mr. Toad.
Interesting.
And when I went to Disneyland for the first time in 2016, like, they still have a Mr. Toad. We've got to go. And my wife's like, "Why? What was that?" I'm like, it wasn't as good as Walt Disney World, but it
It
scratches that itch.
Sure.
It scratches that itch.
I read a story on Reddit today in preparing for the show where this lady was she was sharing a story about her child, and I forget the age of this kid. I think she was like 5 or 6. And she was, you know, she started getting into YouTube and getting into like stories about parks, and she was obsessed for some reason with Mr. Toad because they go to Disney World all the time, and she didn't know that there was even a Toad ride. And she's like, oh, wow, that would have been so cool. And every time they go to Disney World, she brings up Toad. Then they decide to go to Disneyland, and this little girl's like, oh, my God, we can ride Toad now. This is going to be amazing. And apparently this kid would not shut up, yammering nonstop like kids do about how excited that she was. You can go to Toad. It's going to be amazing. They ride Toad. The kid is freaking out and just loving everything until they got to hell. And the ride was over.
Oh, no.
And the mom looks at the child and she's like, hey, do you want to ride again? And the kid's like, no.
Oh.
Never talked about Toad again. That was it. That killed Toad for this little girl is the actual thing that she loved. Never meet your heroes.
Yeah. Well, and so as you were kind of going through the history of it just now, I was looking at Daveland, just going through the old photos, just kind of looking through it.
Yeah.
And there's a whole section that says that's hell. That's just photos of the hell section. And I started scrolling over to those. And my first thought was like, there's no way in hell that Alice would ever be able to go on this ride.
Now,
she would freak out.
Didn't we take her when we went, when she was like 2?
I haven't been on that ride in so long. No.
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 Yeah, I mean, it's a lot. It's a lot. It's a lot. But Walt's worried about the elderly, you know?
Yeah.
But like...
I think it's terrifying.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
And I mean, we're Christian folk. We've grown up to respect and fear hell, but still the bizarre nature of getting hit by a train and going to hell, and just it was all just such weird fun. And then you found out that the other side was different. And there was a part of the ride where if the cast members timed it right, the cars almost hit each other. Like that's the way it was designed. Rolly designed it with those two tracks. There were 2 times where the cars almost went head on. It was just amazing.
That's wild.
And I don't know. As a scared Christian child, I still somehow enjoyed this ride so much.
Well, yeah. I mean, ultimately, you know, it's fake.
Well, yeah, we knew. It's just a ride at Disney World.
Oh, yeah, like, the ride too.
Come on.
I had to say it. I'm sorry. Okay. That is the history of Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, everybody.
That was a wild ride.
Like I said, there's not a ton of information because it's basically since 1983, it's sort of just been the same.
Yeah.
Well, but that's all you need.
And even before that, they didn't even change it much.
Yeah. I mean, they added like new gags and then like some figures. But I think that's what lends to the charm.
Yeah.
Those plywood flats, you know, just like the Pooh ride kind of in Critter Country for the most part. That's why I like those. That's why I like that ride.
Yeah, it's not complicated.
It's low tech. Yeah.
And one thing that you touched on very briefly, but I wanted to bring up is the queue for that ride post 1983 is actually pretty cool.
It's awesome.
It's great. Shaded. It's actually like standing in that line. If you have to, is actually kind of pretty.
Mm-hmm.
It's a like really nice part of the park.
Yeah.
And there's like the statues and the like, I don't know what they're called when it's like a statue, but on a wall. Like
wall statue,
wall bust, a bas relief.
Well, it's like a wall bust, but it's just like it's like a, I don't know. Anyway, if you go there, you'll see it. But
it's cool.
Yeah.
Okay, let's do this. We're gonna take a quick break, and then we're gonna come back. Eric is gonna get his window out of the way. Or I'm never gonna hear anything. He never hear the end of it.
I can save it for another time. I don't know.
No, because I got to take a break. I'm gotta come back and do something.
Okay.
So. Let's do that. We'll come back. We'll do the window. We'll get out of here. And then we'll jump over to the secret show and do some news. So hang on, everyone. It's ears up. We'll be right back.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And now, back to the show that ignites your dream wish of imaginations and magical color wonderment of forever.
Ears hey, thanks up. For sticking around, everybody. We are going to do Eric's window. But first, I want to say, you know what? Shout out to Jimmy. Jimmy was out here, I think, a couple days ago for work or something. And he went to the 21st Amendment in San Francisco.
Nice. Good for him. 563
2nd Street. So if you want to be like Jimmy and you want to be cool when you come out to the San Francisco Bay Area, go and visit the 21st Amendment Brewery right there on 563 2nd Street, right near Giants Park, AT&T Park, Giants Stadium, whatever it is. And if you can't get across that bridge, which is probably like $1 million across now.
Something like that.
Yeah, don't worry about it. You can go to the one in San Leandro as well. They have a beer garden. Cheese curds are there. And a big giant brew house. I think you'll probably get a tour there too. It's a great place. The 21st Amendment makes incredible beer, and they're great people serving you awesome seasonal and year-round favorites like Hell or High Watermelon, Hell or High Mango, Back in Black, if you can find it, which is a black IPA, which is probably one of the only black IPAs that I like.
I haven't seen very many at all lately other than that.
Yeah. No, it went away. And even Back in Black went seasonal. Because it's just not really like in demand anymore, which is fine because a lot of people,
here we go. Soapbox.
Beer rant. Yeah. It's like pumpkin beers. Not a lot of people make them well. They can be made well. And so they're not popular when they're around, but the people who make them well, make them well. That's what I think about Back in Black and black IPAs in general, where it's like,
fair.
Yeah, I mean, I know for a fact 21st Amendment's right there, and I maybe have had one more that was pretty good. The rest is like, this is not. I don't. It's the dark malt with the hops sometimes clashes. A lot of times,
it's a lot.
I was trying to remember something the other day. Don't they have like a pomegranate beer?
Hell or High Pomegranate, I think.
So that must be coming out soon or something.
Oh, yeah.
Pomegranate's a now kind of fruit.
Not now, but right now.
Like right now.
Hell yeah. Looking forward to it. And you can too. So anyway, check them out. 21st Amendment. Ask wherever you find good craft beer. Ask for the 2-1-A if you haven't tried it yet. And it'll do you right. All right, Eric, what window do you got?
We've got George K. Whitney Jr. this time. George was born in 1922. He was the son of one of the Whitney brothers.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Everyone you know the that. Whitney brothers. Oh. And actually, you might as we go on here.
Uh-oh.
The Whitney brothers were George Kerr Whitney and Uncle Leo Whitney. So George was born to George Kerr Whitney Sr. and Ava Charlotte Whitney. Mom came from Australia. They all met in Australia. Dad and uncle moved to Australia during World War I and ran some amusement parks down there. That's kind of how they got their start in park operations. So this is a parks family. They developed several processes for running amusement parks. They developed some photo processes that helped them, you know, kind of expand what they did at their parks, a lot of revolutionary things. They moved back to America and opened up Playland at the Beach along Ocean Beach, which is apparently the name of a well-known beach in the San Francisco area.
That's right.
It is.
And it's very cold in Ocean Beach.
Yes, it's not like the beach that you think about.
Yeah, it's a northern beach.
Basically, yeah.
Well, Playland, George Sr. said, Playland is a nickel and dime business and will do as well as long as people have nickels and dimes in their pockets. George Jr. said, we did pretty well during the Depression. Good, clean, fun diversion.
All right. So I guess people did have nickels and dimes.
They did. George Sr. claims that bingo was invented at Playland. I don't have a lot to corroborate that, but this comes from an interview with George Jr.
To the happiness of seniors everywhere.
Bingo.
Exactly. During the World War II years, George Sr. said, Playland did a fantastic business. Sailors had plenty of nickels and dimes.
Well, it's true. See, so I just Googled bingo invented, and the first thing that comes up said, it is said bingo origins can be traced back to 1530.
Yeah,
when a lottery known as Loguicio del Lotto d'Italia, which is the Italian lotto, the original name of bingo.
Wow.
Oh, that's great.
So now I hate bingo.
Well, look, everybody's gotta pretend like they invented something.
Yeah, in the early 20s, Hugh J. Ward first came up with the concept of bingo in Pittsburgh and began running the game at carnivals in the early 1920s, taking it nationwide in 1924. He secured a copyright on the game and wrote a book of bingo rules in 1933.
Well, don't let Hugh Ward tell that to George Sr. The Whitneys eventually bought the Sutro Baths Museum.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And the Cliff House properties in San Francisco.
All right.
I see San Francisco people nodding their heads because they know what these are.
Yes.
Yes. The Cliff House is a very, very famous restaurant, or maybe was. Actually, I feel like it got sold recently.
It got sold, it closed down, and then they said it was going to open, but I don't know anymore.
It's very ritzy, expensive, fancy place.
Yeah, but it overlooks the ocean. It's like right on the edge. The Sutro Baths are right below it, the old bathhouse, and you can go and like explore the ruins, basically. And that's the closest thing we have to ruins out here is an old bathhouse.
I want to say there's 20s. A famous scene, too, in some movie or show that ends there.
There's a lot of things that happen there.
Yeah.
It's very famous in this area, for sure.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad I basically wrote that like these people will know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
They'll fill in the blanks. Well, George Jr., before Disney, went to the University of Washington and San Francisco State University. He joined the Army Air Corps in World War II. He was an engineer and an armament specialist.
Sure.
Following the war, he managed rides and games for Playland. So he went back to the family business.
All right. Good for him.
Yeah. So he eventually ended up getting hired by Walt Disney when Walt went up to Playland and said, this is one of the he's going around finding other amusement parks and saying, here are the things that I want to do. He hired George because he knew how to handle operations. So in the early 1950s, he came up to Playland, met George Sr., met George Jr. Jr. impressed Disney, hired him on as the seventh employee of Disneyland.
Wow.
He was the only member of Disney's original team who had practical amusement park experience.
Wow.
Famously, Walt Disney didn't want to make an amusement park. He hated amusement parks, apparently. But he needed somebody who actually knew how to make like lines and things that people would walk to.
Yeah, it's like he knew that he could make a better amusement park, but just by making it look like a movie set.
Right.
Yeah.
That's all. You know, that's all. But you need to run the thing first before you can change the thing.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah.
And so George joined the team. He had a very high opinion of Walt Disney throughout his life. He really enjoyed working there. He loved working with the other designers on Disneyland, and he was particularly proud of maximizing the passenger flow of the Adventureland boat ride at Disneyland, as he called it, so the Jungle Cruise. Hmm. And he planned lots of attraction queues, entrances, exits, that kind of thing in Fantasyland and around the rest of the park. That was his thing. He knew how to get people to go to the places and keep people flow working.
Nice.
Now, he only worked for Disney from 1954 to 1958 as the theme park's director of ride operations. After he left Disney, he took some Disneyland ideas back to the Whitney parks. So he went back to the family business.
There you go.
He changed some old dark rides to new dark rides and basically worked for the company for years as as the company kind of devolved. He and his sister ended up inheriting most of the company when his parents died and his uncle died. And she sold a chunk of the company and he ended up losing Playland. But he kept a hold on the Sutro Baths and the Cliff Houses. He ended up buying some other attractions nearby, like the Camera Obscura.
All right.
There you go.
Owned the Camera Obscura. It existed before he purchased it, but he updated the facade, added all of these signs saying, come see the giant camera. He updated the Sky Tram that was apparently near there and added some waterfalls and other things for people to look at. So he was very, very proud of what he did with the family business, even though part of it had been sold out from underneath him. Eventually, he went on to work at World's Fairs in Seattle. So the World's Fair in Seattle as Century 21's Concessions and Amusement Division Director. This is a World's Fair that Walt went up to visit in the 60s to kind of see what they were doing. He was impressed at how many visitors the World's Fairs would pull through. And Walt described the fair as pretty nice, but too small.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, why not?
All right. George went on to be a World's Fair consultant in Montreal, Brussels, and Osaka for their World's Fairs, and he designed the 1960 Squaw Valley Olympics.
Well, there you go, man. Traveling the world designing stuff.
And
lines, basically.
Oh, yeah. He sold off the remaining Sutro Baths and Cliff House and other beach properties in 1972 for $6.5 million in 1972.
That's a lot.
Wow.
That's a lot
Good
of money.
Good Lord, that's a lot, yeah.
He spent the rest of his life, he left the valley and never went back and traveled the world and eventually settled near the Whitney Brothers' original hometown of Friday Harbor, Washington. He died on September 25th, 2002, after a long illness in that town. He is survived by two children and several grandchildren. Now, George's window on Main Street is right above the Market House. And it reads George Whitney, George abbreviated GEO, period. George Whitney, guns.
Guns. Oh. Okay.
It's been there since the park opened. But why guns?
Been there since the park opened. Was he the first window?
He was one of the first windows.
I get, you know, and since we started doing this, I guess I forgot, or maybe I didn't really know or understand that the windows are. I thought they were relatively recent in the
I didn't know that they were that old.
I don't see proof that it was there in 1955, but it was one of the earliest, and it could have been there at the park open. Dave Land has a few pictures. We can take one of Dave's. We can look through Dave's shots. But yeah, it's basically like, well, we think it was there when the park opened.
Hmm.
Just as kind of a tongue in cheek, like, this guy built the park. One of the people who built the park. Let's put up a window. But
there's two names on this park, Walt Disney and mine.
But yeah, why guns? So a part that I left out, George Jr. created the Golden Gate NRA in 1972. Right. That's wrong. The Golden Gate NRA is a national recreation area, a beautiful and protected national park spanning 82,000 acres. No, it's because he was an armament specialist in World War II, and they probably joked around about guns. I don't really know. The man was in charge of guns in World War II.
What a childlike fascination with things that go bang. It's like, I can write literally anything probably on this window. Nobody would ever know. Guns.
Guns.
That's just what was on his mind. Just guns. That's awesome. I love it.
A lot of this came from outsidelands.org. Look up this website if you want to read a lengthy interview with one of the men who designed Disneyland. This is a website that is dedicated. It's an old website that is dedicated to the history of San Francisco's Richmond, Sunset, OMI, and west of Twin Peaks districts.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but the city has a lot of like segmented areas. For being 7 square miles by 7 square miles, it's a lot of different neighborhoods, man.
And there's a lot of cultural differences between them for being 7 miles. Oh, like, God, it's wild. Yeah.
And it's cool. They did an interview with this man in 2002, like
right before he died.
Let's see. So September 6th, 2002 is when they did the interview and he died. I already lost it. September 25th, wow. Weeks before he died.
These people killed him.
Yes, they killed him with a 3-hour interview.
Jeez, I almost did that to Josh Freese.
but
I don't think about it still. I don't think about it constantly.
Or Rolly.
Yeah, well, yeah, that too. I did, probably kill him, Rolly.
You probably did. But yeah,
I contributed.
Check it out. It's one of those bizarre windows where you go, guns? Why guns? And that's George K. Whitney Jr., had more experience with amusement parks and guns than we'll ever have.
That's true. That's probably true. Very good. I appreciate it, Eric. Thank you.
Yeah, that was great. And honestly, I have this newfound fascination with the Sutro baths because I've lived in San Francisco. I've never been there and I didn't know anything about it.
If you want to read more, there are many pages on outsidelands.org that can tell you more about the Sutro baths and the Camera Obscura and the Cliffs houses. And
it's so weird doing these shows and like really trying to pull out good information because you sort of go down rabbit holes. And one of the ones that I just remembered now, I posted in Discord when I was doing research for my show about the prefabricated building.
Mm-hmm.
And the Soleil or whatever, it led me down this path to find out that the first fabricated buildings in California came from China. It was during the gold rush when the Chinese immigrants were coming over and they realized there were so many people coming to California, they just didn't have places to stay. Mm-hmm. So they would order prefabbed houses, shacks, basically, shipped over from China. And they would just like interlock, planks of wood. They were just interlocked together and they would just stand up and they were shacks or whatever. So like the gold rush brought in this. So I don't know.
Wow.
Crazy.
It's interesting, right? Where it's like,
yeah,
man, that is going to China and importing stuff is just, it's old. It is not anything new. It is not anything that you can't point to one president and say they started this or whatever. This is how it's been. I don't know. I thought it was very, very interesting.
Yeah.
All right. We are going to get out of here, everybody. We're going to pop over to the secret show. If you are listening live right now, that link is in Patreon already. If you're not listening live, you can go to Patreon and watch the video if you want, but you can just, get the podcast or whatever too. That'll be up, soon, whenever.
Sure.
3 things to do now. 3 pods to edit. But anyways, that's beside the point. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. I appreciate it. Thank you to Sully of the 21st Amendment for being the guy who makes the good beers. You know what I'm trying to say?
Absolutely.
Anyway, thanks a lot, everybody. We'll see you.